Hello and welcome to COVIDcast, a weekly Low Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effect of coronavirus on the world and international life. My name is Roland Raja and I'm the director of the International Economy Program at the Low Institute in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we are sitting down every week with experts from a range of fields to discuss the implications of coronavirus for the world. You'll find all the previous episodes on the homepage of our website. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Brad Setzer, who is a Senior Fellow for International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations. Brad is one of the most insightful analysts when it comes to really understanding the nitty-gritty of international economics. Among other things, he previously served in the US Treasury from 2011 to 2015 and also served on the US National Economic Council and US National Security Council. Today, we'll be talking about what's been happening in emerging economies and how this has again revealed just how important the US dollar is to how the global economy functions. Brad, thanks for joining me today.
No, it's wonderful to be on your show.
So clearly this is an incredibly difficult time in the global economy, but it's been especially difficult for the emerging economies. In particular, they've seen massive capital outflows, and particularly in March and April this year as COVID-19 became a global pandemic. And this really got a lot of people very worried. Things do seem to have eased off for now, but inflows haven't really returned, and there's still a risk that we might see renewed outflows at some point. So Brad, just to kick us off, can you just briefly walk us through what's been happening and how do you see this whole episode in terms of what's been driving it, and also, you know, why have outflows abated for now at least?
Well, I think, you know, you have to kind of go back to the events of early March, when it became clear that COVID-19 had spread outside of China and clear that there was a real economic shock that was going to be necessary to limit the virus's spread. You know, without a treatment, the only effective way of limiting viral spread was some form of economic shutdown. And as that became clear, became very quickly a financial market shock. And a very kind of classic financial market shock where investors who thought they had a relatively safe asset that paid 10 basis points more than treasuries, a money market fund that invested in safe short-term bank and corporate paper, those investors suddenly got scared and they only wanted to hold short-term treasury bills. And that same dynamic rippled through all global markets. What previously had thought to be fairly safe was now considered risky. And when investors started pulling money out of money market funds with a tiny bit of risk, started selling long-term treasury bonds as they delevered, you had a kind of classic market panic, where investors who had put money into emerging economies started pulling that money back and seeking the safest of safe assets. And as a result, you had one of the most sudden, large draw of foreign financing that most emerging markets had experienced. Certainly the most rapid withdrawal of foreign financing that anyone had seen since the global financial crisis. So that sort of set in train the dynamics whereby for most emerging world, the emerging economies, setting aside China's immediate neighbors, the financial crisis preceded the arrival of the virus and on any significant scale. You can throw in a story around an oil price war between Russia and Saudi Arabia if you want. That added to the stress. And the stress was feeding on itself. Now, markets did stabilize. I think they stabilized in large part because the Federal Reserve stepped in with amazing force, with an enormous expansion of its balance sheet, with large purchases of treasuries, and with full use of all of the Fed's emergency authority. Emergency authority can only be exercised with the support of the U.S. Treasury. Throw in some stabilization in the past few weeks of the oil market as Russia and Saudi Arabia made peace, and throw in the beginnings of the restart of the Chinese economy, and you got some modest stabilization. But it's very modest, I would say, very fragile. And for many emerging economies, the pressure continues.
What are the risks then going forward? I mean, is the worst behind us? I mean, markets have now understand that COVID-19 is a real thing and it's a big deal. They've presumably priced that in. So how then do you see the risks going forward? And who would be at risk? I mean, amongst the emerging economies in particular.
Well, look, the market now has recognized the severity of the economic shock. But there are a set of countries that have managed to survive to date by drawing down their accumulated reserves. And so long as oil prices remain low or tourism remains shut down, or if you needed foreign financing to roll over your debt, foreign financing remains scarce, an important set of countries are going to be using their reserves. And so even though the most important shock and the peak of market stress is past, some countries are living off buffers and borrowed time. And so for them, the risk continue. The most obvious case of ongoing risk is a country like Turkey, which has been steadily drawing down its reserves. An interesting case, but one which isn't at immediate risk, is a country like Saudi Arabia, which has drawn on $20 billion of reserves a month. But that's fine, because if you have $500 billion in reserves, you can go through $10 or $20 billion a month for a long time. Brazil continues to be under considerable stress. And within the Asian region, Indonesia is the country that stands out as having the most significant vulnerabilities. In general, countries that have any kind of balance sheet weakness, whether it's too much debt or too few reserves, are at risk. Indonesia is at risk because its reserves remain relatively low, and because it has historically relied on foreign investors to buy a portion of its government debt and to finance a portion of its fiscal deficit.
And, you know, it's interesting when you talk about, you know, the response in terms of and why things have abated. And you mentioned the Fed has played the powerful role. No mention of the IMF here. And everyone, of course, would like to see the IMF do more. I mean, what's your view? They've done something. What's your view on what they've done and what role they're playing in all of this?
Well, look, the Fed acted creatively and with an awful lot of force. And in some sense, the Fed has been so effective at stabilizing the bond market that some countries have been able to reaccess private market financing. Indonesia placed a big dollar bond, hasn't been able to get foreign investors into its rupiah local markets, but as long as it's getting access to some foreign financing, it isn't going to run into the arms of the IMF. So part of the reason why the IMF hasn't been at the center, to be honest, is because the Fed has been relatively effective, both through its balance sheet expansion and through the dollar swap lines. But I also think the IMF simply hasn't been all that creative, hasn't been as bold as it could be. And as a result, the IMF has been mostly on the sidelines in the big emerging economies. One consequential decision was not to have a global increase in reserves through the IMF, a so-called SDR allocation. I think the IMF bowed to Trump administration pressure there, but it shouldn't have. But the IMF also came up with a new crisis facility, the short-term liquidity line, that no one has taken up. It was probably poorly designed. It doesn't offer enough money, and it doesn't offer the money for a long enough period of time to make it attractive. That said, for some countries, it's only a matter of time. Countries that have underlying weaknesses will eventually run through their reserves and eventually have no choice but to seek IMF financing. We're starting to see that in some small cases, Lebanon, for example. But I would think there's a couple of big cases on the horizon as well.
Let's just, you know, take our gaze a little bit higher. And, you know, what does this whole episode tell us about then, you know, the centrality of the US dollar to the global economy and about the ability of emerging markets to really wean themselves off this problem, so to speak, or self-insure?
Look, the dollar remains the currency that is used around the world to denominate most trade and to denominate an awful lot of the world's financial assets. And so long as that's the case, in a crisis, you're going to need dollars. And that's what we've seen. And in a crisis, the U.S. can provide dollars, the Fed in particular. In some sense, you can make an argument that had the Fed not stepped up, not provided dollar swaps, not allowed dollar-based lenders of last resort to function around the world, that that could have been a threat to the dollar's dominance, because then dollar markets globally would have seized up. But since the Fed did respond, the dollar-based system, in a sense, survived to fight another day. Now, there is the problem of the risks that come with using the dollar to denominate your debts, using the dollar to denominate a lot of transactions. And a lot of countries would like to reduce that risk. And one of the things, though, that this crisis has shown is that even those countries that were relying on foreign investment in their local debt markets have seen that only provides some insurance. It protects you from the impact of a big fall in your currency. So it all, in a sense, allows you to accept a weaker currency without bankruptcy. But it also has intensified some run dynamics, because foreign investors don't want to see the value of their investment in your local markets fall. And so there's pretty good evidence that the more you rely on foreign investors in your local bond market, the more stress you've come under. So the bottom line is that people still want to have dollars and still need dollars in their reserves, and only those emerging markets that have had fortress-like balance sheets have really been able to skate through this without a ton of financial stress.
And then, of course, there's China and the RMB. And so they want to make the RMB a global reserve currency. But it also, you know, in watching this whole episode, it feels like China and the RMB have basically been very conspicuously missing in discussions about emergency liquidity and so on. So is this just evidence of the limitations that the RMB faces? I mean, what does this tell us about those ambitions of China to see the RMB become a global reserve currency?
Well, I think it shows that the RMB isn't yet close to being either a global reserve currency or the currency that denominates a lot of transactions around the world. So right now, most countries don't want to hold a lot of RMB in their reserves because they know when trouble really gets intense, what you really need is still the U.S. dollar. I think that it was also suggested some fundamental limitations on the RMB as a reserve currency, in the sense that countries that accept RMB as opposed to US dollars in exchange for their exports really can only spend those RMB inside China. So you're limiting your trade to trade with China. You in Australia, I think, sell an awful lot of iron, and until the recent unpleasantness, a lot of agricultural goods to China. But if you accepted payment in RMB, you couldn't use those RMB necessarily to buy goods from Europe or from the United States or from a host of other markets. And that's generally true. It's much more useful to hold dollars than to hold RMB. And so until that changes, and frankly, until the U.S. fails to step up in a crisis and the dollar-based system seizes up, it's very hard to change.
I mean, it's interesting, though. I mean, of course, in these days, all the talk is about the U.S. versus China. And for the last few years, especially, the U.S. has been trying to compete with China in trade and investment and infrastructure. But then it has this other area where it has complete dominance, which is in terms of the currency, in terms of the dollar. But it strikes me that the U.S. doesn't really make a lot of use of this as an asset in terms of, you know, really trying to attract people towards the United States. It's mostly used for the sanctions capability that comes with it, so as a means of basically repelling states away. Why doesn't America make more use of the US dollar as a force for attraction? I mean, many would complain that the Fed has been too selective, for example, in who it doles out these emergency swap lines to.
Well, I mean, the fact that the Fed swap lines are the most powerful form of financial defense around means that being friends with at least the Fed, if not the United States, is still quite valuable. It is a form of defense, but it is a very important form of defense. So any country which now has access to the Fed swap lines would be very reluctant to undertake policies that would lead it to lose access to those swaps. In some sense, because the swaps are a tool of the Fed, not a tool of the U.S. Treasury, they've been used primarily as a source of financial stabilization, not as a source of political influence. I broadly think that's the right approach. The Fed's mandate is to assure the stability of the financial system and make sure that global instability doesn't feed back into the United States, and to achieve its goals of maximum employment and price stability in the U.S. Its mandate doesn't include providing political swap lines to gain political influence. It is not the PBOC. It is not a subordinate, not independent central bank. It is a fully fledged independent institution that draws its own conclusions, makes its own judgments about access to the swap lines. Where I think the U.S. can be faulted is not trying to compete more directly with China to provide financing for infrastructure, to provide financing in times of crisis through the Treasury's balance sheet. And I think there the U.S. hasn't made full use of its financial power. You can debate whether the U.S. should do this bilaterally or whether the U.S. should just, say, support a much bigger World Bank that lends a lot more to a lot more countries to support a lot more infrastructure and thereby competes much more directly with China's Belt and Road. But it certainly is the case that the U.S. hasn't made full use of its government's financial power. I think it's also in part a function of the belief in the U.S. that markets know best, that markets are better at allocating financing. But frequently, markets don't compete with China. So if you want to compete directly with China in a political influence game, you probably need to play a political influence game.
Mm. In that case, then, if you're an emerging economy, particularly a larger one, you're not getting very substantial help from the IMF in prospect, the US or China. No one's really doling out a lot of easy support, at least. So what are the options then for the emerging economies in order to, you know, really get through this crisis? I mean, the key seems to be you need to run a fairly large, very large fiscal deficit if you're going to keep your economy and your society afloat through the pandemic. But then how do you finance that? Some are starting to experiment with the central bank basically stepping in. So, you know, what are your thoughts about if you're an emerging economy, what do you do then?
Well, look, we are largely in a world of self-help. There hasn't been a lot of broad-based financial assistance to big emerging economies. There wasn't an SDR allocation. There wasn't a global increase in reserves. And the IMF hasn't come up with a facility that the big emerging economies find attractive. So you're left with tools that you have. So one tool is if you have foreign reserves, you can use them. Another tool, and some emerging economies are experimenting with it, is to have your central bank buy your own government's bonds and do a form of balance sheet expansion or quantitative easing. That, at the margin, tends to make it easier for most countries to run larger fiscal deficits, but it tends to make foreign investors a little less reluctant to hold on to your debt, as the central bank presumably is pushing interest rates on it down. But ultimately, that's a trade-off for the country to judge. They have to choose between a weaker currency and easier access to central bank to financing for fiscal deficits. One thing that I would note is that for countries that have, and this is kind of like a super technical, wonky kind of thing, but for countries that have positive short-term interest rates, the quantitative easing is a little different than in the case of countries that have zero interest rates. So when the central bank is buying long-term government bonds, it frequently will be issuing short-term central bank bills. So it increases the supply of short-term paper and reduces the supply of long-term paper. And for many investors, right now at least, short-term central bank paper is still a fairly attractive asset. So you can discuss quantitative easing and how that impacts different emerging economies. But don't forget that for most, the most powerful tool right now for attracting foreign inflows is still paying a positive coupon and paying a little bit of interest, which you can't get in the advanced economies.
Now that's fascinating, Brad. I mean, clearly this is an incredibly difficult time in the global economy, especially for the emerging economies. They do seem to, particularly the big ones, be on their own. So they're going to have to, I guess, experiment in those sorts of ways. But let me just wrap up by thanking Brad for joining me for today's discussion and offering his really great insights on these issues. COVIDcast is a limited edition weekly podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleagues, Sandra Rigby and Jennifer Reinhart, for production assistance. And keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast. And you can stay up to date with all the latest developments on coronavirus via the Lowy Institute's widely read digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thank you all for listening today, and we'll catch up with you again next week.